Welcome to the Right to Reason podcast. I am your host, Robert Stanley. Today, I am talking to possibly the best human being that has ever guested this broadcast. You'll find out why I say that soon. Topics include activism, terrorism, fake news, BlackRock, being a bone marrow donor, Airbnb safety, the military-industrial complex, and free speech. This conversation with Prabhat Gautam is as refreshing as it is motivating. He makes me want to be a better person. I expect he'll have the same impact on you.
It's the Right to Reason podcast.
This episode of the Right to Reason podcast is brought to you by our patrons and contributors like me. We have all recognized the value of the unrestrained marketplace of ideas and have decided to make a difference. You can make a difference too. Contribute at patreon.com/right and learn more about your right to reason at therighttoreason.com. Your activism is appreciated.
Prabhat Gautam, LA's leading voices in the worlds of entertainment and activism. Prabhat created Positive Television, which has produced 800 charity events. 800? Wow. Events in LA in 21 years and has been a key connector that helped create or finance Game Changers, Forks Over Knives, that's clever, The Paw Project, that's P-A-W, The Paw Project, and the Animal Advocacy Museum. Prabhat led the efforts of the West Hollywood Fur Ban in 2012. In 2018, he helped produce the 50th anniversary memorial event for MLK Jr. after meeting with MLK III. Fascinating, fascinating. Prabhat, so happy to be talking to you, sir.
Wonderful to be talking to you. For all the listeners out there that may or may not know, Robert likes to do these calls early Sunday morning, so that way we'll feel like we're in church. The worst church are brought back to our lives. Thanks for waking me up early on a Sunday morning, Robert.
Sure thing. Everybody can find positivetelevision.org in today's show notes. Tell me a little bit about yourself, man. I mean, you seem to be a pretty well-connected guy and like a genuinely good person. That's rare. Rare on this podcast.
Well, you know, I'm going to blame it on my Oklahoma roots heritage, but, you know, I was born and raised in Oklahoma and, you know, attended the University of Oklahoma and, you know, had a good life there. And I just felt like if, you know, it's always my question, people, if you had $100 million tomorrow, what would your life look like? Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it started my human rights journey with Amnesty International in college. And I thought, how do I want to make a difference? And I thought it's putting together charity events. It's helping, you know, hopefully get people excited about wanting to make a difference in the world. And that brought me to Los Angeles. And as I love to say, I wanted to pick the most narcissistic, self-absorbed city in the world. And I found it. And if you can change it 1/100 of 1%, then that's an awesome, you know, ripple effect. And, you know, hopefully I've made the city a little bit better than worse. And I've certainly met a lot of amazing people that are driven to make the world better. So it's been exciting. And, you know, it's brought me somebody like you, Robert. So, I mean, something good came out of it, right?
Yeah, this is definitely the pinnacle of your career. I can see that was sarcasm.
Yes, actually. It's why I'm talking to you. I hear once people talk to you, it's over.
And it's not, I catch them on the way down.
They've now been banned off everything else. You were cancel culture before it was cool.
Yeah, I get everybody. I can get them on the way up and I can get them on the way down. I can't get them when they're at the top. So I don't know. I don't know what that says. But hey, speaking of Oklahoma City, were you there during the bombing?
I was. I was in college OU. And, you know, for people that have never visited Oklahoma or know about Oklahoma is sort of known for, oh my gosh, we have a major breaking story. Mm-hmm. Cat went to the neighbor's house and we think that it may have climbed a tree. So it's always sort of this exaggerated news. And it's, you know, it's that kind of small town kind of feel, even in Oklahoma City. So, you know, on the day of the bombing, you hear the news coverage. And unfortunately, you know, you just think it's just the media kind of hyping up something because you didn't know. Like, you know, at the very beginning of that morning, April 19th, I mean, you know, they didn't know, is it some kind of like gas explosion? Is it, you know, the thought was it was just a natural, you know, sort of natural issue that, you know, something just went wrong in a building.
I was listening to Howard Stern right at the moment of the 9/11 bombing and or the 9/11 terrorist attack. And And it was really, it's really interesting seeing it in real time, you know, long after it occurred, because they're talking live while it's happening. And he's saying to Robin, he's saying to her, wow, this is crazy that, you know, this plane ran into it. And then the second one hits and he's like, this is such a weird coincidence. Like, how could the, and then as like within like a 30-second window, you just see like a group of five people talking and they start saying, wait a minute, is this terrorism? I think this is terror. Like, and I can only imagine you being in Oklahoma City that it was something probably kind of similar where everybody's like, this is very, very bizarre. How do you explain this? And even back then, terrorism wasn't such a quick go-to.
Yeah, exactly. In the thought of like houses. And again, yeah, Oklahoma was just, you know, it's the heartland of America, right? It's the middle of the country. It's nobody hates us there. Like, they're going to hate the coast. And also, right, I mean, the biggest threat to Oklahoma is a tornado. So you felt very insulated and you just never, I mean, you know, I was born and raised there. Like, it is the last thing you would have ever considered. And, you know, I don't know who's ever scared of terrorist attacks all the time, but certainly in the middle of the country, we just never saw it and never expected it. I mean, and that is such a, you know, moment that shakes your everything, because, you know, that's the part of Oklahoma that's at, you know, it's, people have gone through there. Like, people know that part of Oklahoma, you know, it's not far from the downtown. And then you start thinking about it. You're like, all right, well, in what circumstances could I have been there? Right. There's some OU hospitals that are out there. So, you know, there's clinics. It's like, oh, if you had a doctor's appointment, would you have been there? What if you just are, you know, driving in the area and something could have happened? Like, yeah. So I think it definitely was a moment where, and I feel really, you know, an immense sadness for people in Oklahoma, because a few years later, you know, they had a giant tornado, like a devastating tornado. I don't know if you remember it.
Yeah.
In Oklahoma City. So you had families that had lost somebody in Oklahoma City bombing, and then they lost their home a few years later. It's like, at that point, it's like, you know, at this being an atheist podcast, if there's a God, they're not rooting for your team at that point.
He doesn't like Oklahoma City.
Like, it's like, wait a second. I mean, I always love the television. Just like, God hates gay people. God hates these people. And I was like, those tornadoes and hurricanes are coming to your towns.
Right.
So maybe God hates the people that hate the gay people. Maybe that's actually what's happening here, folks.
But that's...
Like, maybe what you think is God's hating the gay people, but, you know, your false god actually is out there marching. Like, you guys might miss something.
It's funny you say that, because that's what I was at Bible college, and that's what the dean of students came over the intercom with at 9/11. Is he said, this is God judging the sin of New York City. And like, it was just something that I thought, I'm seeing it on TV. I can see this will be a historical event. It's still not really affecting me. And then it dawns on me, my brother was supposed to be at the towers.
Wow.
Today, like, right, you know, I'm at that day, you know, on the 11th, and I'm thinking, he's supposed to be there. And I start calling and calling, nobody's answering. And for a second, I'll avoid the linger longer radio trick, but, you know, just say he's okay, he was fine, he wasn't there, just by happenstance and fortunate coincidence. But for that short amount of time, I started thinking, did I just lose a family member to the terrorist attack? It made it real for me. It made it really real.
Yeah. And what's crazy, so, you know, my sisters went to law school out of New York and lived there for a really long time. And I went to visit her in New York, and I was supposed to fly back on the 11th from New York to Los Angeles. So, I mean, and as people say to me, like, please let us know what your itinerary is so we will not travel with you. You somehow
Holy
keep finding
shit.
Disaster. But you
were supposed to be on a plane on 9/11 in New York.
From New York to Los Angeles.
Jesus.
So, yeah, and none of those four planes that day left from New York. So it's, you know, everyone's always like, you could have been on the plane. I was like, and none of those, they were New Jersey, D.C.
Okay.
Planes, that Boston, that were the planes that all crashed that day. So, so being on a plane in New York, I mean, not that we know of, you know, I mean, who knows, right? When I've read into it and researched it, I mean, there's one theory that there were supposed to be 10 or 11 planes that day that were going to all crash. I mean, that is a whole layer of, you know, and again, for me, growing up in Oklahoma, going through that, and then being in New York, I mean, I 100% was like, you know, this is what happens, you know, sadly, whenever you have countries that are killed, you know, destroying each other, you're going to upset people from one side. They're going to do something their way. Then we have to do something back. Like, it's this constant back and forth. And I was like, well, you know, these are obviously some outraged people from the Middle East. And the more and more I research it, I have very serious doubts. Like, I don't know how much you've, I know you had a 9/11 truther on before. Yeah. When you dive into it, there's some crazy financial anomalies. You know, people bought, you know, there's all these stock tricks where if you believe a stock will go down. And the University of Chicago professor said there's an exorbitant amount of stock in United and American Airlines the week before, and where people were going to, you know, they're going to sell it a few weeks later, and with the understanding that the price would go down. So, you know, I'm not a stock junkie, but, you know, that whole world of shorting stock and all that stuff. So there's, if for people that really deep dive into it, it is fascinating because
it's spooky.
Some of the people that were the hijackers are alive. Like they're alive. They're like, you know, they're like, it wasn't me. And they've done press conferences. And then we're like, oh yeah, they're Middle Eastern. They all look the same. They all have the same names. And then some of those guys are like, no, that's my photo. I'm alive. It wasn't me. And I just think, all right, I think that's American media in a nutshell. Like there's all this, oh, we got to go find the truth. We got to find the truth the day of. And the next day they go to, well, we got to go to war. Where what's like, well, let's really find the truth. Like, why did people make a ton of money? You know, Donald right. Rumsfeld did a press conference September 10th that talked about, you know, $2 trillion missing from the Pentagon. And the place that got hit at the Pentagon is the finance office where 24 of the 28 accountants got killed. Like, that's random, I'm sure, and just coincidental. Like, you know, I just think at this point, like, my sort of life philosophy and religious philosophy and everything happens for a reason. And the reason is money. Like, yeah. If somebody gets killed, it wasn't their time. It wasn't that God wanted them dead. It's that their cousin did something to the wrong person, or they spoke truth to power and they had to be silenced. Like, that's the reason. And I think that happens way more than we want to recognize it. You know, there's
whatever happened.
Robert,
to,
well, I'm basically saying this because Robert's going to be this is his last show, folks. Somebody's going to take him out.
I mean, just for this. The one that freaks me out.
All the religions, but now they're coming together to take him out.
Yeah, no, there's no religion as powerful as it's just the dollar. But the Pentagon one really seems like a missile, you know. And I'm not saying that that's what I think it was, but if I lean toward any 9/11 conspiracy stuff, you know, it's not like I'm like, oh, Bush did 9/11. You know, I don't go that far at all. But yeah. the Pentagon missile one, or the plane that was supposed to hit the Pentagon,
yeah.
And I see, you know, people say, well, it did. Okay, there's a hole there. I don't know. It doesn't. Here's my thing. The evidence of the plane hitting the Pentagon and the evidence of the plane hitting the towers looks very different, right? Because on one end, they say, look, that looks like a huge explosion. Why didn't that plane just get incinerated when it hit those towers? And you say, oh, well, that's a lot of fuel, man. And then you say, well, okay, well, let's apply that to the Pentagon. And that same person will go, well, that plane, I mean, it's going so fast, it's just going to get incinerated when it hits that wall. You know, so it's like, it's not that I ever think that the government wouldn't do a conspiracy. I think they're doing them all the time, you know, not on that level, but it's just whether or not they could. And could they shoot a plane with a missile that is trying to fly into the Pentagon? Yeah. Would they? Oh, definitely. I mean, at that point, it's almost your responsibility to down the plane.
Right.
You know, I know that's cold, but.
You're right, because it's more harm, right? Like,
right, it's levels of threat. Yeah, levels of risk.
If a plane of 200 people goes down, 200 people died, and it's tragic, and we don't want that to happen. But if a plane with 200 people hits a building with hundreds or thousands of people, you're picking, you know, what's the least damage. Well, the other thing too, like, I mean, I highly recommend people, you know, before YouTube was taking everything down. I mean, years ago. I just did a YouTube search. Like, you don't need to look at Alex Jones. You don't need to look at, you know, the truther people. If you don't want to do that, just do ABC, NBC, CBS. Just Google, like, Donald Rumsfeld, September 10th, Pentagon loses, you know, it's actually $2 trillion. I think I said billion earlier. It's $2.3 trillion with a T that was missing from the Pentagon. And Donald Rumsfeld does a speech on September 10th, 2001. And then the main accountants that would know how to account for that money die the next day. And then the same thing, what you're talking about, Robert, is like when you look. So what's crazy to me, I went back and looked at it. So the plane missile, whatever, something hits the Pentagon, right?
Mm-hmm.
So at the time, Bush is president, Cheney's vice president. Who gets out of the Pentagon and becomes a first-level rescuer? Donald Rumsfeld. You got, guys, I definitely encourage you guys to look this up. Rumsfeld gets out of the Pentagon, and he's helping like lift people onto stretchers. Like, he's helping them provide care. Now, I'm all about you got to help everybody you can help, but I think the Secretary of Defense should be bunkered down somewhere after this is attacked, what, 3 or 4 during the day, and like figure out how do you protect our country. I don't think you need to go like do CPR and first aid. And that to me is suspicious is an understatement. I don't want the third most powerful person in the country to be out there for photo ops, because that's what it looks and feels like. And I totally forgot that that had happened till I researched it again a few years ago. And I was like, oh yeah, Rumsfeld did run out there. And then you think about it, you know, back then, I mean, people miss the history of Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld and Cheney worked for Ford. Like, these are people from the early 70s. You know, they had political aspirations. So, you know, I'm not saying Rumsfeld went out for a photo op because he thought he could be president one day, but it certainly would look like that. Like, I'm not saying maybe, it, but actually, yeah, I'm saying it.
Maybe you're just underestimating what good character and wholesome kindness a man like Donald Rumsfeld might have.
Right. Have you ever seen the documentary The Unknown Known? The verbal gymnastics he does about, you know, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Because to me, I always think American history is very selective, where, you know, in World War II, we talk about the Holocaust, and then it's like, all right, Holocaust happened. Oh, yeah, by the way, the U.S. also turned away a lot of Jewish people for their death. So we were no great rescuer of, you know, of Jewish people. And then we sort of gloss over, oh, yeah, by the way, we also dropped the atom bomb and killed a bunch of people in Japan. Like, oh no, that's something different. And the same thing, like, we talked 9/11, and then it's like, oh yeah, and we also did a fraudulent war in Iraq that's based off of weapons of mass destruction that never existed. And again, people try to do their mental gymnastics to say, oh, but actually Saddam Hussein did have weapons there, he just moved them before we got there.
Yeah.
And I was like, he's not hiding the weed, folks. Like, this is a little bit bigger than that. Like, this is, if you look at what happened, right, in the industrial war, you know, the military-industrial complex. That war and the Afghanistan war has led to how many years of perpetual war in America? You know, 20 years. And I mean, and you know, I'm on the left as I think you are, as I pick up that you are. I always like to say there's two things that I got to applaud Trump for. Number one, he's out. Like, I applaud him for not being there. And two, he did not get the U.S. in a perpetual war. And I certainly think, and you talked about it in one of your podcasts, which I agree with, that Hillary Clinton, Obama, Biden, you know, George Bush, Reagan, like this sort of establishment political people, war is what their financiers want and ask for and need, and they're perpetually in war. And Trump, you know, to his credit, did not get talked into it when they kept trying to push him to go to war and Iran and North Korea. So it's like, okay, those two things I can applaud him for. And then let's return to regularly scheduled programming where we can dislike everything else he did. But at least with those things, you know, he was like, I don't have time for war with people. I got to figure out how to extract resources from them so they can actually help me build more of my hotels so I can fraudulently rip people off. So let's stay focused, people.
It was just this month, Democracy Now!, you know, journalism of just pure integrity and honesty for as long as ever since I heard of them, and after the Trump administration and now with the Biden administration, it's like they're gone, dude. Everything that I thought they believed in, they got that Trump derangement syndrome thing. Now they just put out an article just this month that says, you know, we're going to hit Biden hard. You know, we're not going to be those the typical MSNBC kind of production company here. Like, we're really going to hit him. And they bring up all his past pro-war legislation, and they say nothing about what he's doing right fucking now. They just totally leave that out because you're not allowed to. You're not allowed to condemn Biden or Kamala for anything right now. And wherever your political place is, you should at least be able to say keeping money from medical services and food services and sanctioning countries like Syria or Venezuela, that's not hurting the government. That's hurting the people. And they don't reference that at all. And I worry, where's journalism going to go if we even lose Democracy Now!, which, you know, used to be that was their whole platform, was anti-war.
Right. And what I think happens, right, is people start to see, right, it's who butters your bread, right? They see that, so. Okay, well, there's, and this is the thing that really, you know, I'm socialist. Like, you know, Bernie's not left enough for me. So I'm so far on the left. That I'm so far on the left that I'm friends with people on the far right. Like, it's funny how that ends up happening.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you see people, it's like, we have to really hold these people account. Like, that, you know, I met Obama in 2010.
Like, oh, really?
When he was the president. And,
what's he like?
He was a nice guy. You know, I mean, we didn't have lunch. It wasn't a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. We talked for 2 minutes at a fundraiser. By the way, if people want to know how to meet politicians in power, you got to write a check. That's the way
okay.
that works. So.
Okay.
So I met him at a fundraiser, and that was a fundraiser where, you know, there was a woman they protested his treatment of at the time, Bradley Manning, you know, pre-Chelsea, Bradley
yep,
Manning,
yep.
and how this person was in solitary confinement. I said, yeah, you guys can argue whether or not a person has the right to reveal, you know, confidential yeah. stuff that's military, even though the military is killing civilians. You could argue that there are some things that are too sacred that shouldn't be released. I don't agree with that, but people can argue that. But then that person should be tried, not just locked in solitary confinement. But I remember, like, you know, Obama being in power, and we were so bothered by drone strikes by Bush. Obama had more drone strikes than Bush. And for those of us who believe in what we really think is, like, you know, people going to trial, and as flawed as the court system is, at least, like, have them have their day in court instead of this just, like, you know, unilateral execution of people through drones. We should criticize Obama. And of course, I was a million times happier that Obama won than John McCain. But in the end, you still should be critical of the person and say, okay, the better candidate for me won, but these are the things that I want to hold that person accountable for, knowing that they can only do so much and they have the other side fighting them. And I think once you have people that are like, my side is good and your side is evil, I think we see that so often in religion, and we say, okay, that's wrong. That tribalism, that nationalism, when people are like, oh, I'm a patriot, I was like, that's just such a, like, are you a fan of the New England football team that cheated to win six championships? Is that what you're talking? Like, no, I'm a patriot. Like a real patriot is somebody who says, when my country does something wrong, I want to hold them accountable. And it doesn't mean storming the Capitol. It means actually holding them accountable and speaking up and talking about it. And I think really what you said earlier is the breakdown of media as we've known it. I mean, I think it's more obvious now because of, you know, a handful of corporations that own everything. But when people talk about, you know, how Trump won the election and this happened and Hillary, I'm bothered with things like Facebook and YouTube. Like, I don't think they should be doing editorial stuff unless somebody outright is saying that they're going to kill somebody. I was one of the loudest voices when they started deplatforming Alex Jones. I said, this guy has every right to speak what he believes. And if what he believes is wrong, then don't listen, don't watch, or create content that says you disagree with this guy. And because the reality is, when you learn and research people, I totally thought I disagree with Pat Buchanan on everything. So I started researching him. Pat Buchanan was one of the small handful of voices against the Iraq War. And he's a Catholic, you know, Christian conservative. If I met Pat Buchanan, he's probably charming. I'd probably like him. And we probably only agree on like 3% politically.
Mm-hmm.
But he has every right to have his voice. And once we start taking people's voices away, I think we're in a really, really dangerous place. I mean, you know, when I've listened to your podcast, what I love is you're talking to people that you have different viewpoints from, and you're giving them a platform. And somebody would say, well, Robert, aren't you giving that pastor a platform where, unbeknownst to you, you're converting people over? And if that's what happens, that's what happens. But but what's probably happening is you're helping educate their listeners on your different perspective. And in the end, if we're just more educated about everything, aren't we a better society? And isn't our goal to have a more informed world rather than an uninformed world where only four people get to vote? Like, what are we trying to create?
I saw some pushback on platforming a Nazi, and I understand that one. You know, I did it anyway. The argument proposed, like, if somebody says, well, would you have silenced Hitler before the Third Reich took over? Would you stop free speech at least to prevent that? And that, you know, made up hypothetical, you know, it's like, well, I don't want to be an absolutist about anything. But other than like that level of impossible scenario kind of thing, I can't see a whole lot of real life scenarios where I would say, yeah, let's limit that person's speech. I mean, even your reference with Alex Jones, where I get it. You know, the Sandy Hook denial stuff was really bad. But guess what? Guess what came of that? Once he was criticized for it, then he came out and said that was all a lie. That is so much more powerful than if you never let him say those horrible things in the first place. To let him say all these horrible things and then go, I was just bullshitting for your money. That does it. That's so, that. So, I mean, at that moment, you think, well, what about the families that were harassed or threatened? You know, I understand that's horrible. And I don't know how you would. How do you create a measurement system for that kind of thing? I don't know. But having him admit to that was all BS, I think, was worth the problem of letting him say those horrible things in the first place.
I totally agree. And I, even when you went to your point about Hitler, like, you know, we weren't alive in the 1940s.
Yeah.
But when you think about it, is the problem that we're giving too much voice to people that are doing terrible things that we don't know about, or is that they're doing these terrible things in secret? Like I would have loved to see 1,000 interviews with Jeffrey Epstein to ask him his perspective on, you know, how, you know, being involved in pushing underage girls into having sex. Like I think we would be in a better place if he would have been held accountable, interviewed about it, talked about it, rather than him going on his merry little way and exploiting, you know, thousands of young girls. And we're like, oh, well, I guess if we don't talk about it, it didn't happen. Like, I always, always, always will believe, you know, it's what they always say. Like, you have to, I think, you have to give voice to people you disagree with, so that way society can say, all right, this is unacceptable. This person needs to be arrested. This needs to be stopped. This needs to be whatever it needs to be. Because, again, like, you know, especially so much of what you do is, you know, highlight religion. Well, how many of those religions were involved in, you know, forced marriage of underage girls, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pedophilia. Like, I certainly wish people would have interviewed somebody from the Catholic Church 30 years ago and said, well, you guys seem to have a little bit of a problem. You know, Cardinal Mahoney, O'Leary, O'Brien. Oh, wait a second. Was that racist? I made every single one. I'm so, sorry, Irish Catholics. Those are the only Catholics I know.
It's correlation, not causation.
People from the Godfather. Those are the other Catholics in it. Yeah. But like, if somebody would have said, hey, guys, this appears to be a bit of a problem, and then they would have been like, oh, well, yeah, you know, then maybe it is a problem. Let's look into it. And they do nothing, but then something happens 3 years later. Far better than nothing happens for 30, 40 years, 50 years. How many kids' lives are destroyed, damaged? Think about it. How many people probably killed themselves because they were molested, abused by a priest, and they had to hide what happened to them, and they had shame and guilt when those kids did nothing wrong, and society failed them. I mean, my early activism was Amnesty International, and I always say to people, if you look at what the death penalty is, like, I am a ardent opponent of the death penalty, and I said, if you look at what the death penalty is, it's a child that's abused, and that we did not take them out of a destructive environment that then kept having chaos in their life and ended up hurting, killing somebody. And now that abuse, when they're an abused child, we're like, oh, we feel terrible for them. Let's help them. When they killed somebody, it's like, we want to fry them. Well, we didn't save that kid. Like, these are kids from really low-income families, and they've come from a lot of trauma and abuse, and we failed them. And I think the same thing on the other side of it is America, we're in such a rush to send our young men and women to war to fight for freedom, then when they come back scarred, because nobody is meant to kill people and see their friends die next to them.
Right.
When they come back scarred and they're homeless and they're out on the street, it's like, well, why don't they get a job? Well, they just killed a woman and her child like a month ago. I don't think it's really time to go get a job when you come back after that. Like, the amount of therapy you're going to need to process that. And then on top of it, it's like, drinking is the least, you know, they need to deal with all of what's happening. Drinking is their way to cover up the pain they're feeling. And they talk about what's PTSD. Like, PTSD was a way to kind of normalize and put a term on, you know, highly screwed up minds of people that saw destruction. Like, I think we have this tendency, especially in America, where we love the neat, shiny bow, right? When it's a little kid that is, you know, that's hurt that we want to help. It's the kid going off to war, but when they end up being damaged, we're like, well, they should just, like, figure it out. Like, what's their problem?
Exactly.
Like, well, we allowed them to be damaged. We didn't. We either put them in those situations, so we didn't save them from that.
It started from a lack of preventative maintenance in our, in our mental health system. Hey, you had mentioned activism, and this is something I read about you. You weren't just like a guy that has started all these charities and gotten all these charities noticed. You actually donated bone marrow to somebody. And when I read that, you know, my first impression of you was like, okay, so this is a guy, lots of money, lots of connections, and doing the right thing with it. You know, like, that's pretty cool. But I didn't think of you like as a, I'm also going to give you some of my body, like some kind of Christ thing. You know, like, that's insane, dude.
It's, so I tell this to people all the time that, you know, I got to meet Obama, I met Jerry Rice, I met all these famous people, and nothing is anywhere close to being a bone marrow donor. Like it is the October 3rd, 2001. It's like the highlight of my entire life. Like, and it's not even close. Like, it's a large margin, and I, you know, it's going to be awful when I get married, and, you know, during the vows I have to tell my wife, this is the second greatest day of my life. I don't know if it's for you, but sorry, you only made the cut for as number two most significant, and I don't even know if you're in top two. Like, that's why I'm probably far from getting married. Statements like that. But no, for me, you know, it was post Oklahoma City bombing. I was like, you know, I just felt like I wanted to do something and give back. And then, you know, I learned a story about a friend of a friend who was a beauty pageant contestant. She's big about organ donation. And I said, you know, I should sign on the organ donor registry. Then from there, I learned about bone marrow donation. You know, you just, and it's the National Marrow Donor Program, so nmdp.org. And you just, you know, you request. Now, I mean, it's so sophisticated. I think you just swab your cheek. You send the swab back. They put you on this national database. Don't worry, guys. This is the actual database you want to be on. The other database is you're already on. Like, the government's already tracking you. It's okay. No, don't worry about that stuff.
It's a different kind of database.
Yeah, it's a different database. But in this database, you know, if you end up being a match, so the young lady's name is Anka, and so she's 16 years old, and, you know, you just hear that you're a match. So the way they do it is when you're a match, you don't get to know the other person's name. You don't know where they live. It's the closest I've ever come to writing a letter to somebody in prison. So, like, they black out anything that sort of determines where you're at, you know, who you are. Because their whole thing is, if you end up donating, they don't want the family to pressure you to donate again if there's a problem. They don't, you know, they'd leave, like, that anonymity for the year. And so, yeah, it really was like donating to a complete stranger. It was this amazing experience. And then, you know, sadly, she dies 13 months later. And, you know, so I see her for the first time at her funeral. And after the year passed, we got to talk on the phone. So for 12 months, you're not allowed to talk. Like, you can have letters, but it's all blacked out. But you can't talk on the phone. You can't meet in person. So after the year, 12 months passed, we talked on the phone, and our health had started to deteriorate. And so, you know, the family was like, well, you know, we were picked to meet on stage at the National Marrow Donor Program event, their annual convention. And then her health deteriorated, so I didn't get to meet her. But I always look back at that as like, you know, I know you have a daughter, right? If I heard that from one of your podcasts, that's like Anka's my kid, you know? Like, I always say, you know, I love all the work that I get to do. And, you know, there's a foster program I'm involved with. There's a bunch of children's charities, animal charities. And it's like, you know, I have all these children that, you know, I get to see, and I have students at UCLA that I get to mentor. I get to see them. I get to see them kind of grow up. I just got to go to one of my mentee students' weddings a few weeks ago. But I never wanted my own kids because I felt like I want to have this free life to do a million projects that I've been lucky to get to do. So Anka really was like my child. Wow. I look at it that way.
How old was she? To
be gone. She was 17 when she passed in end of October 2002.
And so, yeah, what you did and gave her 25. An additional year of her life? Is that? Am I understanding that correctly? Yeah. That's amazing.
And her parents were so thankful. And her mom, you know, such a sweet lady, was like, you're an angel that's brought to us. And I was already atheist, you know, at the time. Mm. And when she was like, you're an angel brought to us, I was like, I just was a guy kind of living his life brought to you. And she's like, no, like you know, God brought us you. And I was like, I believe it was Delta that brought me to you guys. But I mean, you know, God via Delta. Right. I'm sure. I mean, there's a pilot, there's a stewardess though. They helped bring me here. So I looked at it like, you know, and that really was such a tough time for me after her passing, because it just doesn't make sense to me and you know, and people will say, well, you know, you gave her an extra year and that's great. And for sure, like, if you have a choice between an extra year and not that extra year, you pick an extra year every day of the week, right? Yeah. For sure, that's better. But a 17-year-old child should not be dying from leukemia. And right. then, and that's where I go to, why does a 17-year-old child from an affluent family die? Like, what is it, right? What is it environmentally? I mean, she's from New Jersey, so I'm sure that, you know, there's a bunch of environmental issues that are there. And who knows, you know, sort of the family history. But I think, to me, it all just goes back to, it's healthcare in America. Like we're not a preventative society. Like, everything is, you know, like, every child, every person in this country should be going to a doctor 2-3 times a year just for a checkup. That's it. Like, are you okay? You know, it's, right. We have more care for our cars than we do for our people. Like, 3,000 miles, go for a checkup. Oh, it's been 12 years. I guess you should go to a dentist, but you don't have dental insurance. So hopefully you can get a job that'll allow you to have dental insurance to do it.
You know what, what weirded me out was at the last checkup I take the kids to, it's, you know, right around age 15, 14, you know what I mean? And the doctor says to me, says, oh, just so you know, they do have to, like, remove their clothes. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's fine. You know, they can stay in their underwear. And she's like, no. Like, they have to remove the underwear, too. And I said, well, why? She says, so first off, we want to make sure that, you know, there's hair growing where it's supposed to at the right time, because that could be signs of other problems. But also, and she says, you know, I mean, no offense, sir, but we always have to check for bruising or anything around those areas. And it was like wow. A reality check in my head where I thought, this is so common that doctors have to check, you know, at random stages of this development, or, you know, at scheduled stages of this, of their development. It blew my mind, you know, and I said, okay, well, let me have a talk first. And I, you know, take my son aside, like, hey, you okay with this? No big deal, right, buddy? You're gonna be all right. You're gonna be, you know, do the little pep talk. He's like, yeah, still, who cares? Who cares? I'm like, okay, cool. You know, I just stepped out of the room, but just, it was weird to me, you know, it just made me think of that whenever you talked about, you know, kids need to get checked up regularly, but our society is so rife with sexual violence that the doctors have to check on the kids. Bizarre.
No, you're totally right. Like,
yeah, I mean,
like,
good. That, you know, that it's happening, because
that, yeah. No, but, that I didn't know they do that like that. And to me, you know, when I think about it too, it's also right. Adults, right? Like, I mean, they'll tell stories of, you know, you can tell if a woman's in a domestic violence situation, right? Because mm-hmm. they're bruising, or and if they go to a doctor, right, that's the one time where it's them and the doctor. So they really, you know, whether they're going to open up about what's happening or not, it's an opportunity to talk about those things. And yeah, what right? Because with children, right? Maybe they're being abused by an adult. Maybe they're being abused by another child. And if that's happening, you want that information to be disclosed. And for me, I mean, I look at the bigger thing of, if a child has leukemia, if a child has has any kind of cancer, if a child has anything that is a health issue, how many? Because I don't know how you grew up, but, you know, my parents were like, you know, you'll be okay. You know, it's in the words of Chris Rock, like, have a little Robitussin, and they'll do.
Yeah, yeah. They're like, put a little Tussin on it.
Well, yeah, put a little Tussin. And they're like, well, you know, if you have this, chai, like, you know, my parents are Indian, like, chai will be good for you. Chai is the grand solution for everything. Mm-hmm. Oh, add some ginger. Well, yeah, I mean, those like, yeah. Home remedies, like, I didn't know my mom was Wiccan. Like, she's putting all these little remedies together. Like, yeah, she was a far better doctor than most doctors. Like, I don't disagree with that at all, that she was. But, you know, the not going, and they for sure did want us to go to doctors. We didn't always want to go too. So it's, you know, a mix of the kids. But you look at, it's like, you don't want anyone not to go to get medical care because of financial reasons. And that's why I just think, you know, universal health care should just be like I always say, even if I choose not to go to a doctor, that's my choice as an adult. But financially, every person should have that ability to go do it.
Yeah.
And the wealthy checked. Do. And if you're really, really, really poor, then you do. But it's really everyone else in the middle that has to make those tough choices of, like, okay, you know, what does my insurance policy cover? What is it not? What can I pay for? And, you know, yeah, do we do the maintenance? So, yeah, but back to, yeah, being the bone marrow donor, I definitely recommend everyone signing up, and you having children. I mean, you know, I mean, hopefully this never, ever happens to you.
Of course,
you know,
of course.
The idea, if they were to have something, you would just want to go save them. And you know, and the young lady's name's Anka. Anka's mom said, you know, we saw bone marrow drives all the time. And we thought, oh, well, we hope somebody helps that child. And, you know, the parents, they're a great family. And she said, we just walked by. We didn't sign up. We didn't think about it. But when it was our daughter, you know, they were going to go to India and sign up every person they could find if they were doing drives in the U.S. Like, she said, when it's your child, it's your family member, all you think of is like, how can I save this person? And it really was, you know, that whole, you know, for me, you know, I look at that 2001, 2002, right? I'm in New York, September 2001, bone marrow donor, October 2002. I was super involved with Make-A-Wish Foundation, and one of the kids, Rachel, she passed away from cancer. So it's just a lot of like big things happening within a 2-year time period. And, you know, and as an early 20 something kid working at dot-coms, you know, 2000, 2001 was, you know, was the crazy kind of 99 to 2001 was the crazy dot-com boom. So you see all that and you just realize everybody's distracted by nonsense. Like, everyone wants fame and wealth, and really what they wanted, what they really want deep down is people that care about them and to, you know, live in societies where we actually know each other's names. Like, we all want Cheers. We all want to go somewhere where everyone knows your name, and they're glad you came.
So. Well said. I love that show. You're in California now, right? You did a lot in New York.
Los Angeles, yeah.
I was reading this article that said Airbnbs are illegal in California, but apparently because they're super unsafe, but people just do it anyway. And I thought, like, that's just freaking crazy. I was scanning over different articles on this, and there's apparently like murders, rapes, all sorts of stuff attached to these things. I had no idea.
You're exactly like me, where I had no idea what happened to Airbnb. So 2 years ago, I stayed in Airbnb. So, you know, I was launching a new event space. Like, so we were doing this media center. And so I stayed in this Airbnb, and I go in there, and I was, you know, my friend said, I think I smell gas. I'm like, no. I don't. So, you know, reach out to the owner. So I don't stay at the event at night. She's like, oh, yeah, maybe it's an old stove. There's a gas leak. Then I end up staying there, and then, you know, my friend comes back. She's like, you know, I really think I smell gas again. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, notify the owner. My friend who's a firefighter comes by. The carbon monoxide detector just goes nuts. It's just going off. So I'd stayed 18 days at a place with a gas leak.
Oh my God.
And I was like, this is so crazy. And then, you know, I reach out to Airbnb. It's like, you guys got to, like, fix this stuff. Like, you got to, like, and so that took me on a mission. You know, we don't look for projects. Projects find us. So after looking at that, I ended up meeting this guy, Eric. His parents are November 2018. So 13 months before I stayed at the Airbnb, go to Mexico. They go to sleep. They never wake up because the Airbnb they stayed at, there was a gas leak and they died. And
oh,
I thought
wow.
13 months later, the same thing could happen to me. And so, you know, there's a group of us that are really trying to push Airbnb now to like up their safety. I mean, there's a lot of issues with these rentals where they don't have smoke detectors. They don't have carbon monoxide. So if you do the premium Airbnb, everything's included. But for those of us commoners, it's viewed as an amenity to have a carbon monoxide detector. And I said, when is it an amenity when it's a basic requirement if you're renting an apartment?
You know? Exactly.
So it really is kind of taking me on this journey where, you know, again, like I think if I met the founders of Airbnb, I'd really like them. You know, I've seen interviews with them. They seem like good people. And, you know, their vision, they're art students. Their whole vision was, hey, these hotels are like charging a crazy amount of money. The original Airbnb was air, you know, the air was air mattress. So the idea was you'd stay at an air mattress in somebody's living room for, you know, $20.
Oh, that's funny. I always thought it had to do with like you fly.
No.
Like, it's always, I don't know why I did that in my head.
Air mattress, bed, breakfast. That was the original
I'm such an idiot.
Model. And what they would do is the owners would go and they would photograph the rental location personally as things got rented out. And now that, you know, this many years later, they're a giant, you know, I think over $50 billion company. There's a giant mega company. So their sort of model is, well, we expect our renters to self-regulate. And, you know, I love my libertarian friends, mm-hmm. but self-regulation is code for we're basically removing all responsibility. And if
right.
there's a problem, we're going to say that there's a violation of terms of use. And it's like, come on, people, like how many Uber drivers assaulted female passengers? And you got a responsibility. Like if you're a company at the beginning, you say, OK, it's not our fault. It's not our fault. It's not our fault. But if it keeps happening, it's your fault. Like you guys got to come up with some sort of,
yeah.
So there's an Airbnb where like people have been kidnapped. There's people have been trafficked. Like There have been murders at Airbnbs, right? And so Airbnb's whole thing is like I totally get if somebody rents a place, they do a party without you knowing. All right, there's no, you had no control of that, right? It's the renter did what they did. But if the owner has a bunch of issues there and you never sent an inspector to check it, what does that mean? Like, you know, you're putting people in danger. So yeah, I tell people all the time, if you go to an Airbnb, bring your, and they actually say this, it's when you read the articles, they say you should actually bring your own smoke detector, your own carbon monoxide detector. And what they fail to tell you, also bring a toolkit, because there might be some loose tiles, there might be some loose,
bring your own article, plumber.
Yeah, bring your own handyman, like a swing bell. This guy ends up dying. Like, you're staying at a place that is not, it's not up to any kind of code. Like, the right. code is, it's the code of money. Like, all right, this person was able to list it. And I mean, there's a lot of shady stuff that's happened. And again, you know, all that those of us that, you know, are on this activist side say is just do it once or twice a year inspection, you know, send somebody in, have them look at the place, or, you know, have the owners do a self-inspection where they do a checklist that they promise that they did all these things. And then if they're in violation, they're in violation. But today it's like, there's no checklist. There's no, when you check out, it's like, how do you rate the host? It's never, this is was there any issue that needed to be fixed?
This is a project you're working on right now?
It is. And because what I thought is after my experience, my nature is, you know, write a letter to the company. Uh-huh. You hope they fix it. And they're not in any rush to fix anything. It really got to, well, you know, we're sorry for your inconvenience. Now their policy is, if you have a problem at Airbnb, you need to tell us in the first 24 hours or it's not our problem. Oof. They've actually gone even further to remove liability, which I think is, it's interesting. So a lot of us that are, kind of in the activist world have, a lot of people that were concerned about Uber and, you know, their treatment of people have sort of taken on Airbnb as the next thing and said, okay, let's, you know, with Uber, you know, they were not willing to release the amount of assaults that happened in California. So the attorney general fined them. And it's like, there's a lot of assaults if you're not making that public. So our thing with Airbnb is the same thing. Like, you know, yet we want them to disclose how many injuries have happened, and we want them to be much more proactive in the safety of their customers. So, yeah, hopefully they'll do that.
There any place you would direct people to find out more about that?
Yeah, so there's a guy out in New York who's doing so what's interesting, and it's sad, is Airbnb has done an amazing job of scrubbing a lot of the criticism online. So different journalists have talked about it. I mean, people can certainly reach out to me, and I'm happy to talk to them. I luckily got to talk to a guy in New York. He's fighting Airbnb because when Airbnb comes into a community, and it's happening in a lot of places where it's apartments, you know, there a bunch of apartments are getting rented, it ends up messing up the rental market. So you have less places available for rent. Therefore, the places that are available all end up going higher in price. And so it's really done giant interference. So he's specifically only working on, you know, how it's affecting, you know, low-income communities, which are communities of color. So he's like, you know, we're really, the Airbnbs are going to poor communities, and they're affecting the rental market. And every place, and, you know, in California and in Los Angeles, they, you know, they passed something where you're only allowed to rent the Airbnb that's your primary residence. So that was the pivot they had to make. So you wouldn't have people that have 25 properties, because you had a bunch of investors. They would buy up, or, you know, a lot of properties. They'd have mortgages on a bunch of properties, and they buy them solely to rent them out. Well, that's stuff that, you know, it affects the housing market, affects the rental market. And again, I'm fine with people making money. Like, I'm not stopping people from making money. What I'm not fine with is them making money while they're putting people's safety at risk, and you know, a multi-billion-dollar company kind of turning a blind eye to it. So
that's exactly, you know, what's happening with BlackRock right now, buying up all these houses. Yeah. They got all that stimulus package money, and the Fed actually hires BlackRock, and they're just going through buying up all these houses. And on one end, you know, I hear the argument, well, it's keeping us from a housing collapse. But at the other end, they're renting those houses out, right? Two people that could have bought the house. So they're renting at outrageous prices, especially here in Texas. Outrageous prices that there's just not, you know, availability to buy a house unless you want to spend $1.3 million for a 4.3, you know, or something like that. But they start renting them all out, and now they're taking our tax money, right? Or at least our debt, however you want to look at that, modern monetary theory concept. But they're taking that money and then using it to profit off of while claiming they're saving us from a collapse. It's really spooky. It's very similar to the Airbnb thing you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I think once people start looking at, like, they always say, like, follow the money, right? I have this thing where, when people talk about kind of fate, destiny, and everything, they said, if your five closest friends are involved in drive-by shootings, your chance of being shot in a drive-by is much higher than me, who's out doing charity work, you who has your family and doing podcasts. Like, right. it's basic statistics. It's the same thing. Like, if people are really there's war profiteers, there's poverty profiteers, like, they're basically taking advantage of crises to make a ton of money. Like, in every other system society, we'd be like, oh, these are price gouging terrible people that should be, like, taken to court and arrested. In America, we applaud as, oh, they're just capitalists, that's all they're doing. Yeah. It's modern capitalism. It's like, yeah, but when it's capitalism that's subsidized by the federal government, then that's when you start having problems. And then it's also when it's not regulated by the government, because that's the other thing that you end up seeing happening so often, of, like, you know, when there's no accountability. And I mean, I always thought, you know, when you saw, right, the sort of the war system, right, you go in, you blow up a country, then you send in the contractors to go rebuild the country, then you realize, oh yeah, no, we still kind of hate that leader, we need to go back and blow them up again. But don't worry, we have the infrastructure people that'll come back and rebuild it. It's like, well, this is a perpetual game where people keep profiting, and who gets hurt? The local people. Like I saw a documentary recently, 620,000 tons of bombs were dropped during the Vietnam War. And so this military guy said, well, we blew up this small bridge three times. And he said, we asked, like, can we blow up the big bridge over there? How about the big road? They're like, no, don't mess with that. So so they're just perpetually destroying this thing. So you destroy it, rebuilds, you destroy it, rebuilds. And it's like 620,000 tons of bombs are dropped. That's a lot of money that somebody made. And then when I learned that, I thought, well, who's incentivized to wrap that war up quick? Certainly not the people that were making money off of it. I mean, these poor kids are going to die. And that's now what I look at it as, right? It's poor kids in America that are going and fighting wars with poor people in other countries to make rich people richer. And the wealthy people in the military are, you know, they're usually high-level military people, right? Like, John McCain was a pilot. Obviously, his plane got shot down and he was a prisoner of war. Like, I understand. But John McCain was a pilot. He was not a soldier on the ground that's, like, in combat. His possibility of death is way less than the person who's, you know, going door to door in Fallujah. You know, obviously those are for the listeners out there. I know Fallujah is not in Vietnam. I know, or Korea. I know I'm mixing my wars. I know, but the point being, he's not on the ground.
Right.
I think it's always follow the money. Always follow the money, and then when you stop following the money, you realize it's still the money, and it's the predominant religion. And when we think about it, right, why did the Catholic Church hide all the sexual abuse scandals? Because of the money, because they would have to pay out, right? And they also knew that scandal is going to cost them, you know, people from coming into their I was going to say churches. You're raised Catholic, right? Were you Catholic?
I was independent Baptist, so a Protestant.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm with you 100%. It was all a money game. And it's a power play. I think that's a fantastic point to end on. Prabhat Gautam actually utilizing money for good stuff. All these charities you're doing, I really appreciate it. If you want to learn more about Prabhat here, go to positivetelevision.org, link in the show notes. You might just be the best human I've had on the podcast, man.
Robert, you're a great human. You've raised good children, at least.
That's all I did, though. I made a kid. Whatever.
And the thing is, What you're doing with your podcast, I mean, it's really, you're giving people from varying views a platform. And the beauty of that is when good people come together and talk about things, it's going to make the world better. And the one, my Prabhat challenge to all the pastors and priests and everybody else out there is while you're building up your congregations, do more public good. Because if you guys do that, then we're happy to have you, you know, as our neighbors and out there. And if you're not doing that, stop trying to get us to sign up to your religion. Because if there is no good component to it, we don't need to read more books. We actually need to see good played out in real life.
Well said. The Prabhat Challenge, thank you so much, man. Have a great day.
Thank you, Robert. Take care now.
Thank you to Prabhat Gotham. Thank you to Dave Blair at DaveBlairMusic.com. Thank you to FeedSpot.com for promoting the Right to Reason to the Top 10 Atheist Podcasts. Thank you to our patrons, Jason Parker, Freethinker215, Alan Marks, Philip Spawn, Bernard Lamborel, Enema Man, Larry Wilson, and our top supporter, Rob Montgomery. You can support this broadcast at patreon.com/right and learn more at therighttoreason.com. Next week, we're talking about the benefits and debating the detriments of communism with Commie John from realprogressives.org. Between now and then, remember that you have the right to reason.
Podcast.